You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So continuing our coverage of justice in the lead up to the election, I spoke with the Children's Commissioner Andrew Beecroft on the state of youth justice in New Zealand and the debate surrounding the lowering of the voting age. So I first asked him, what are some of the most pressing issues that he's seen in his role so far?
Yeah, well, I've had the role now for about 14 months. It's been a terrific opportunity. It's a privilege, but it comes, I guess, with an enormous sense of responsibility. And of course, you feel a slight anxiety that you do the job as well as you can. Overall, you could say there are 1.2 million children in New Zealand. That's under the age of 18. Virtually 25% of the population are without a vote, without much of a voice. So a key part of the job is ensuring that their interests, what's important for them, is constantly put before the public and before the government, because it's a group that we could do much better with. You could say overall, 70% of our children, young people, do well, some really well, some world-leadingly well, and that's terrific. We can be proud of that. 20% do badly, 10% do really badly, and probably they're worse off than many Western world comparators that we like to judge ourselves against. So that 70, 20, 10% breakdown is quite a good picture overall of how we're doing with our children.
Mm. And what developments have you seen while in this role, or that have you worked towards?
Well, we've already had a number of priorities. Early on, we wanted to have 17-year-olds in the youth justice system. I can come back to that. We're particularly concerned with the disproportionate rates that Māori children appear in all the figures. That's not all Māori, but it's a subgroup of Māori who are too often in that 10% group, and that distorts the figures. We've worked hard, I guess, with Ōranga Tamariki to have policy input and advice, and we're working with them as an independent monitoring organisation to ensure that Ōranga Tamariki gets the best input that we can give.
Mm.
We're also really keen to talk about how children's voices and children's perspectives can be factored into policy making. Actually, Kelly, we do that extraordinarily badly in New Zealand. We don't seek out what children are saying and put that into the policy decision making process. And we could do that a lot better.
You're at the head of, leading the debate into wanting to lower the voting age, is that right?
Well, we've certainly floated it, shall we say, for public discussion.
Mm.
I think that we face something of a crisis in our democracy that the lowest voting age groups are between 18 and 29. Now, not much higher than 60% of those enrolled actually vote.
Mm.
And I think it's important that we think of ways about how our children and young people can better connect with the democratic process, to feel part of it. There's something wrong, if a big group of younger New Zealand citizens just don't get involved. It's not good for our future. And it's part of what's going on in Scotland and Austria, Brazil, Argentina. They're all respected countries that include 16 and 17-year-olds. So it's time we had the debate, time we had the discussion in conjunction with teaching civics at secondary school, how our society works, how our parliamentary process works. I'd be pretty excited for a good discussion about that.
What advantages do you think we would see if the voting age was lowered in terms of connecting children to civics, perhaps, or to just knowing more about politics?
Yeah, exactly. Understanding. I think if we understand the system, we're more likely to take part in it.
Mm.
We also know that all the research shows that people who start voting early in life are much more likely to vote for the whole of life.
Mm.
And our system is based on an individual vote that's cast in a thoughtful and intelligent way, knowing different policies. And I think we've got to rejuvenate our democratic process by involving younger people in the system at an earlier age.
Mm.
So I think there'd be significant advantages. Yes, there are disadvantages. I mean, you could say that 16 and 17-year-olds are more easily influenced. They may not take it so seriously. They maybe don't have the life experience. Mind you could say that about a few adults as well.
Yeah.
But it's worth the discussion, I think.
Yeah. So coming back to what you said before about whilst you've been in this role, the youth justice age was raised to 18. So this was a positive outcome for you?
Absolutely. I think we were, there was a misapprehension, you know, Kelly, that somehow the youth justice system was a soft and pretty weak, almost kumbaya singing, Milo drinking system that had no teeth and didn't address the real issues. Nothing could be further from the truth. The youth justice system was about holding young offenders to account, but also looking at their underlying needs, what caused the offending, and while it's not a perfect system, it offers a better chance than the adult system of getting young people out of a trajectory, I hate the word pipeline, but out of the pipeline of criminal offending. And we know that the system can deliver. I mean, it gives me no pride to say it, but 14, 15, 16-year-olds are being sent to prison for serious offending. What happened with 17-year-olds? So it's not as if coming into the youth court, they somehow escape liability and that would be some sort of consequence-less system, but it would be imposed in a way that was youth-specific and took into account all their background. And, you know, it would give us the best chance, I think, of helping our children become meaningfully involved in adult life.
Specifically, this this raise in the age, it only applies to low-risk offenders. Is that right?
I'd rather put it this way. It applies to almost all young offenders,
right,
apart from a very small group, predicted to be 100 to 110, of very, very serious offenders. Now, most of that group would often go from the youth court to the district court for sentence anyway. So it may not be that much of a change. But, you know, Kelly, I'd like to think that there would be time to reflect on it. And if the change works well, that all 17-year-olds could be included in the youth justice system. The public could have confidence about it, because what they don't realise is there's always flexibility. We can always move young offenders out of the youth court into the district court. It's the same judge always, but just with the power of adult imprisonment. And that's always been available. And that's something that I guess ought to provide a reassurance to the public that when there needs to be a very firm and clear response, it can be provided. Actually, I'd like to have some 18 and 19-year-olds able to be moved into the youth justice system too, because some are developmentally immature. They're struggling with brain and other developmental issues.
Well, some people are calling for it to be raised to 21. Do you think that's a target? Or?
Oh, it's something certainly worth considering. I'd gone so far as to say that some vulnerable 18 and 19-year-olds could easily and much more appropriately be dealt with in the youth justice system, but it could go higher. That's a matter for good debate. I mean, the important thing to know is most of the rest of the world does it.
Right.
We've got a world-leading youth justice system, but we're out of step there. And also, and this is a bit of a debuzz, as my daughter would say, when it comes to the debate, but it's what we signed up to in the United Nations Convention. I mean, we signed that to include 17-year-olds in our system. And we've got to adhere to our obligation to deliver on what we committed to. And That's because it's a better system, really, and it's a better way to be youth-specific and respect children and to ensure we've got the best way of helping them, as I said, to become productive adults. So we can be quite reassured, in my view, that it was the right thing to do.
Just finally, you said in a recent interview in June that you had set a marker of 2030 to half poverty in New Zealand. I was just wondering if there's any progress with that so far or... you know, you said you wanted to set kind of markers just to see if that progress was being made towards 2030 rather than just having that one target.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Now, that 2030 target is one of 16 what is called sustainable development goals. Now, 192 countries in New York in 2015 signed up to those sustainable development goals. So, again, they're not optional. And when I go around the country, hardly anybody knows that we've signed up to those. Hardly anyone knows what the sustainable development goals are, but they relate a lot to environmental issues and protective issues. But one of the goals, the first actually, is that signatories, that's us, are committing themselves to reducing poverty, including child poverty, by half by 2030. So the goal's been set, the target's been set. What I said was it would be good to see a series of markers put in place every 5 years or so to see actually every year to see if we're bringing the number down to get to half by 2030. Because we're not going to wake up on the 1st of January 2030 and magically have arrived unless we've had a target or a plan to get there. Now, that's something we've been pushing strongly for, that we get an explicit plan with a series of markers, as you put it, or wayposts telling us if we're getting there. Now, that's going to be something for a new government, whoever that might be, to take on board and grapple with. But from a children's perspective, our rates of material disadvantage in New Zealand are way too high.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.